Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the 8-Bit Adventures Podcast. This is episode 271. I am your host, Sean Hayes, and sorry for the noisy intro. It's a busy day at the household. But I hope you're all doing well. Hope you're all staying cool and staying hydrated. Looks like the light decided to change. So I got to turn some lights on. There we go. We might have to turn the other one on in a little bit. But that's okay for now. Hope you're all staying cool. I know most of the audience here seem to be Massachusetts natives. So, like, we're kind of used to the seasonal heat here. We have the infrastructure for air conditioning and stuff. But regardless, you know, do what you can. Stay hydrated. Stay out of the sun. Stay indoors if you have air conditioning. At least, like, get a fan on you. Do what you can to keep from overheating. So, just a little PSA for that. I could have advice for those who might be listening in the UK. I'm not familiar with the infrastructure over there. From what I understand, it's not really built to handle heat. So, I mean, if you can get your hands on an air conditioning unit, do so. But that's probably difficult. I guess if you have a basement, that's key. That's good. spending time below ground, a lot cooler down there. So, try and stay in the shade, stay hydrated. Wear light colors. So, all right. And if you do have to go out in the sun, sunscreen. Make sure to wear sunscreen. Okay. All right. PSA, weather-related PSA, we're done. So we've got some news this week. And then our deep dive is we did get to see Thor Love and Thunder. Probably my most anticipated film of the year. So we're going to talk about that. And my thoughts on that, since it is certainly a controversial film with how people feel about it. So, all right. Why don't we get right into our quick fire news? All right, so first up, the Nintendo eShop, specifically for the Wii U and the 3DS, will close March 27th, 2023. So what that means is users will not be able to make new purchases after that point. So sort of like what happened with the Wii shop, where you can't buy anything, but you will be able to still access it to re-download previous purchases. Users, however, will no longer be able to add funds as of August 29th, 2002. So if you've still got eShop gift cards and you want to use them for those eShops, like, get those funds in now. Otherwise, you won't be able to add them. Although, if it's, like, for a generic eShop, you know, and you have a Switch, like, you just use them for the Switch at this point, I feel like. So we knew it was coming. At some point unfortunately, this is the reality of digital media, is that services, you know, aren't going to be maintained forever. Especially with, you know, consoles that are now defunct. So that's, a case for, you know, either backing your stuff up on a hard drive, is one way to mitigate that, but also buying physical media when you can. So, next up, similar to the NES kit, Lego will be producing an Atari 2600 kit on that will be available April 1st to coincide with Atari's 50th anniversary. The set will retail for $240. It is, how many pieces is it? It's a pretty big set. Where is the number of pieces? Just under 2,600 pieces. 2,532. So they missed it by 68 pieces, which feels like they could have somehow added 68 more pieces in there. That would have been great. But sort of like the NES one where it has little fiddly bits, you know, you'll be able to sort of build a control, like a joystick, the actual console itself, as well as a cartridge holder and a number of cartridges that you can then also stick into the 2600 console. Now, because it is just a Lego set, disclaimer, not an actual functioning Atari 2600. Okay? However, it looks great. You know, and I've certainly been eyeing the NES one for some time. We don't have room for it. So, here's hoping that this one stays on the shelves for a while, because it is really pretty. Lego really nailed the sort of the browns and orange that are really nice accents on the color scheme for that system. So yeah, for all the both Atari and Lego fans out there. Next up, a second game workers union for one Activision Blizzard. This one coming out of Albany for Blizzard Albany, formerly Vicarious Visions. This is sort of right in my neighborhood. Has announced its QA department has started the process to form a union. I believe it's like they're just going with like Game Workers Alliance Albany, like so that way like they're essentially the Albany chapter of the Game Workers Alliance, like to try and build it into this bigger group. So I think this is great. I think I'm curious to see if this will start, like, since now we have both Raven Software and now Blizzard Albany, is if more of the smaller studios that are part of Activision Blizzard are going to start picking up and unionizing. So yeah, that happened. Like, that was like brand new news. You know, I was kind of just seeing like, what's the deal with Blizzard these days? And this was the most recent thing. And so for it to also be, you know, a studio that literally is sort of in my region, that like I could have applied for an internship for in college, like, because it's that close. You know, I'm glad to see them pushing for that unionization. Best of luck to the folks there, and I hope that more people catch on, because I really think it's a path forward to solving a lot of the issues. And I talk about this like almost every week, but yeah. And here's hoping like that maybe other departments there. So I was a little surprised that it's just the QA department. So I don't know if it's like, I don't know if it's just because QA is typically the one that's hardest hit when crunch happens. Like, I don't know if we see that happen with other departments that are like in the planning phases of games. if we'll see unionization there, because like typically they're not the ones that are hit with, like, if most of your work is done like well before like programming goes into the game, like I don't know if you're really affected by crunch and therefore you might not feel the need to do this, but yeah, so here's hoping that Games Workers Alliance. Games Workers Alliance, Albany. Here we go. Yeah, Game Workers Alliance, Albany. GWA, Albany. Okay. And also, hopefully, this time, Blizzard lets it go through and not try and stir some trouble up. Since the last time they did that, when I talked about it for Raven Software, there's actually a suit with the National Labor Relations Board over their behavior concerning that process. So, Microsoft, it did issue a statement saying, like, it's basically labor neutral, so, like, if you guys form a union, like, go right ahead. Where, you know, it's, you know, and if you don't, you don't. Like, we're staying out of it, essentially. So, I guess good on Microsoft for just being hands-off about that, and letting the process happen. So, all right. Next up, there is a new Unearthed Arcana called Wonders of the Multiverse. It's a little bit of a beefier Unearthed Arcana than we've gotten before. It's like 14 pages. Focusing on basically Planescape type stuff. So, little, you know, kind of surprising, given like the push for Radiant Citadel and then Spelljammer. So I wonder if they're just like really just going to start pushing out a lot of these sort of extra planar campaign settings, you know, moving with this multiverse concept. It'll be interesting to see how they reconcile Spelljammer and Planescape, since like the two previously didn't really work with each other. Or like it was weird. So it'd be interesting to see how they sort of rework that. But it includes Glitchlings, which are basically another construct, racial option for characters. You know, I'm a little discouraged seeing that, like, Wizards has now put out two Unearthed Arcanas that have constructs that basically are more exciting than Warforged, because like that was the whole shtick with Warforged, and now and like they watered them down for Eberron, and now they've kind of pushed the boundaries on that in a way that, like, I hope that they eventually do a second pass on Warforged, sort of like what they did for a bunch of the other races in Monsters of the Multiverse, is that they do another pass on Warforged and kind of bring them up to par with the other new ones coming out. Because this, like, it has a bunch of the stuff that Warforged already have. It addresses a bunch of things. So, like, Glitchlings and Autognomes are both constructs, but they have specific features that let you heal them with cure spells. And this one, like, it gets a fly speed, and it's, like, resistant to charm. You know, and has like a base armor class equivalent to medium armor. So, you know, there's a lot going on there that I don't know if they're going to pair it back eventually or. Yeah. It would have been nice for a unified sort of, here's a template for how to do constructs that started with Warforged and then branched out from there. But we'll have to wait and see. Fate Domain Clerics, I gotta say, Fate Domain kind of boring. It's very combat focused, and you think for Fate, could have a lot of really interesting sort of roleplay exploration mechanics built into that. And instead, it's just very sort of mediocre, or maybe not mediocre, but just a very vanilla, almost like diviner, like divination wizards of like, you know, oh, I look into the future and I'm going to give you advantage on a roll that you just did or something. You know, it's a case where like, yeah, I mean, that's that, you know, it might be effective for combat. But it's not really flavorful. Like, it doesn't really evoke Fate in a way that seems cool. Like, it just seems to, like, very cookie-cutter abilities. So I was not impressed. And my interest was piqued as a person with a campaign setting where there is, like, a god of Fate. So, like, this would be perfect. But I would much prefer like to have like story stuff built in there. And instead it's very much like replacing dice rolls and granting advantage or disadvantage, or just, oh, you get to cast a bunch of very situational divination spells, you know, for free, like once a day or something. A bunch of new backgrounds that follow the tradition of granting a feat now. But then also, like, the role-playing feature that, like, they were giving backgrounds has now been basically, like, almost entirely replaced with the feat. And again, that I think that's boring. All right? Like, if ultimately your design goal is first level characters should start with a feat, just grant them a feat. Like, just have it be an optional rule or something to grant them a feat and keep backgrounds the way they are. And they should have worked on making the roleplay features for backgrounds better. Because it looks like we're moving towards just ditching it entirely. So now backgrounds are just, it gives you two skills. It gives you either some combination of two tools or languages, and your starting gear, and like some starting gear, and then a feat, and like that's it. And that just that seems like it's not enough to me. It seems like they're taking something like that had the capability of being something really cool, and instead just like, instead of trying to work on it, just stripping it out and saying like, oh yeah, here's just another mechanical benefit. And the idea being that like, oh, well, pick a feat that doesn't give you an ability score bonus. And like, there's a bunch of feats that would help the social roleplay aspect of the game that you can't take because they also give you an ability score bonus. So yeah, it's frustrating to me. Bunch of new feats. It feels like they reprinted a bunch from the last UA that was focused on giants and primal stuff. I could be wrong. But like this UA was like kind of split in half, where it was like extra planar stuff, but then also giant stuff. And I don't know where that is supposed to meet. Like, it almost feels like they could have done this as two separate UAs. Or something. And then a bunch of spells. And the spells are all based on, like, the deck of many things. So you get a bunch of, like, card-based spells. Love it. There's one where you just, like, create, like, a spray of cards that go out and just, you know, hit people. So it's very Gambit-like. And then there's another one where you actually build a literal house of cards. But like life-sized, as opposed to, you know, like playing card sized. So that's interesting. I think out of all of it is glitchlings are kind of the highlight there. You know, and maybe a couple of the spells. the rest of the stuff is like, you know, once again, like when they do include the roleplay features for the backgrounds, it's like, oh, you know, when you're in your hometown or when you're in an area where your faction's recognized, like you can get modest food and lodging for free. And it's like, are you incapable of coming up with something cooler than that for a roleplay feature? Like, have you literally not seen anything that any other RPG team is doing? Or indies? Like, I don't know. Like, when you look at something like Dungeon World, there are specific abilities that work better in terms of roleplay than the stuff for backgrounds in D&D. Especially since nothing from the backgrounds really affects gameplay at all. Aside from, like, the skills and maybe if you get a language. Like, tool use comes up so, like, unless it's thieves' tools, rarely ever comes up. So it'd be great if there's a little bit more integration there. All right. So that's that. I don't want to do a whole rundown on the UA because this is still quick fire news. So, that'll wrap that up. And then on to our last bit of news. Microsoft has added Discord call integration to Xbox. So it's a little convoluted. Like, Nintendo Switch owners are going to roll their eyes and have a little bit of a chuckle at this. So, this allows you to use your Xbox, to sort of, use your Xbox, to essentially like pipe in a Discord call so that you can use it for voice chat. However, it requires an app on your phone. Sounds similar, Nintendo fans, that you then have to use to connect your Xbox account to your Discord account. And then what you do is, once you've set up the Discord call, is you then route it through this app on your phone, which then allows you to open it up on your Xbox. And then, like, you specify what machine, and then it allows it to open up on that machine. Hopefully, this is a temporary solution, because it'd be really great if there was native support. I would love to see this on every console. You know, because everybody complains about the lack of voice chat features on Switch, and now you have to use the app that nobody ever uses. And honestly, I feel like you could solve that problem by just having Discord on the Switch. And I know Sony is still working on integration for PlayStation as well. So, I think at this point, you know, I'm coming at this from the days of TeamSpeak and Ventrilo. So, I think the fact that Discord is kind of the go-to option for that sort of stuff these days, I think it's great if consoles would have integration with it. Especially if, say, your console that doesn't have a native voice chat feature is that somebody else did the work for you. And personally, is it going to allow you to voice chat with randoms on your console? No. But I consider that to be a feature as opposed to a bug. So, there you go. All right. That is going to wrap up our quick fire news. So, it is time to review Thor, Love and Thunder. All right, so I'm going to warn everybody now. I put it in the show title. I put it in the notification. And basically general rule for spoiler cast. I'm going to talk about spoilers. This is your warning, okay? Normally, I also give it at the top of the show. I forgot to. I apologize. However, this is your warning now. So if you have not seen Thor: Love and Thunder and you care about spoilers, come back to this episode. All right. Gonna give you a 5, 4, a 3, a 2, and a 1. Okay, you've been warned. So, all right, this is rocking, what, like a, it's not great on Rotten Tomatoes. Like, it's positive, but it's not like a really high score. And all sorts of controversy, people, you know, a lot of people saying, that it's like the worst Thor movie, the worst Marvel movie, that it's shoddy work, and just like absolutely bashing the film every time it shows up, like an ad shows up on social media. So my wife and I saw it over the weekend, and I have to say, right off the bat, it was not as good as Thor Ragnarok. Okay? That said, I don't think it's anywhere near as bad as people are making it out to be. I think people are just blowing it out of proportion. This is still a far better movie than Age of Ultron. Which I know, let's not like setting the bar awfully high, but, I think for me also, like, this ranks better than Eternals. Gosh, I'm trying to think of what else came out. And just, like, stuff that it's also weird for me where, like, a lot of Marvel films, like, I enjoyed when I saw it, and I think they were really good, but then, like, I saw it once, and I have no desire to see it again. Like, I have a hard time with Infinity, like, going back and watching Infinity War. Like, Endgame, not so much. Like, Endgame I can go back and rewatch, but, like, Infinity War, just because of, like, I mean, of how it's kind of like Empire Strikes Back, where everything's bad. But, like, it's even worse than how Empire Strikes Back ends. I have a hard time rewatching that movie. But that said, I mean, I think the film sets out what it achieved to do, which was to take Thor Ragnarok and then make it sillier. Like, that was a goal. I think this is also achieved by the fact that the story is essentially, or like the plot of the film is essentially a story being relayed by Korg, who, while at times like wildly insightful, also has a tendency to like embellish a little bit and be a little silly. So, I'm okay with it. I loved seeing Natalie Portman come back. I think she's great as the Mighty Thor. I personally, I don't know if it was a contract thing or if, they felt they needed to kind of close a chapter on Thor's life, and sort of give some closure to this duo. I would have preferred her to have survived. I really like Natalie Portman, so that's just my own personal preference. My hope is that this has sort of redeemed her view of superhero films, since after Thor 2, not very good. She was not a fan, and that's why we kind of didn't see her for a while. But yeah, you know, I think if you're a fan of Taika Waititi's humor, I think you have to come into this as if it were sort of an absurd Taika Waititi film and not like an epic, you know, action Marvel, you know, tug at your heartstrings film. You know, there's going to be, you know, serious moments and sad moments in it. You know, I know that the development of this film was a little bit of a mess. But I think those moments do serve as a contrast and lend to the absurdity of the funny moments. You know, and I feel like people want Thor to be this super serious all the time sort of Lord of the Rings style hero, as opposed to, you know, essentially we get someone who fits a little bit more with, you know, the Avengers at this point, where, you know, especially like if you're kind of immortal, you know, kind of a god, you know, you're a god, that maybe you don't take stuff as seriously, and that, like, you know, maybe you find humor is a way to cope with tragedy and difficult times. But also the other thing to remember is Korg is the narrator. So this also could be him providing his own embellishments. This is something that, like, I never really thought of a lot, like, growing up when watching films, of, like, who's the narrator? Is the narrator reliable? And, like, there were a lot of times when I didn't think about it when reading books either. And it wasn't until, like, very recently when I really started to think about it again, when people talk about Patrick Rothfuss's Kingkiller Chronicles. And, like, that's literally the whole point of the book is unreliable narrator. Since it's, you know, the main character talking about his life. And so, like, is he essentially this, like, fabled chosen one superhero or not? You know, or is he just adding these bits in? Because they make it very clear, like, he makes it very clear at the start of the first book, like, I am presenting this to you as fact. You are going to take it as fact. Like, you are not going to question my narrative. And so, like, that's, it's the story that we get. But yeah, no, I had a fun time. This is a fun film, you know? I think I'd rank it probably maybe on par or maybe even a little bit higher than the first Thor film. Certainly over The Dark World, you know, and behind Ragnarok. So, I mean, if we're going to rank them, you know, Thor Ragnarok, I think, is still the best Thor film. And then somewhere jockeying for second, third place, or maybe they share second, 2.5 place, is this in Thor 1, and then Thor 2. But yeah, no, I mean, let's put it this way. Marvel's made a lot worse movies than this one. You know, and I think, I don't know what people who are bashing on this film are expecting. Like, if they were expecting it to be more serious, I don't know. You know, I will say, you know, was a little shocked that we didn't get more of the Guardians. I don't know if that's like a contract thing, or scheduling thing or what. I thought we would have seen them a lot more and that there would have been a little bit more character development in them helping Thor instead of just sort of being just a opening tableau and here you go, dropping you off. So that was a little bit of a disappointment, but also, I don't know, Guardians has its whole thing going on too, so who knows? But Christian Bale, great as Gore the God Butcher. You know, I'm kind of a little surprised that like they didn't have him get away at the end of this film. And that way then he like kind of becomes a bigger threat. Like I could have seen Gore becoming the main threat for Phase 4. You know, from like how he is in the comics. But that said, I mean, I'm also fine. Like he, you know, definitely makes for a perfectly fine sort of one-off villain. You know, that might have also been a casting thing with Christian Bale being like, no, I'm not doing franchises anymore. one of the things that I wanted to know, and I was talking with my wife about this, was I thought it was really interesting. So Gore's whole motif when presenting is like he's wearing essentially monk's robe, like Christian monk's robes. And they're white. And he is white. With like sort of very ritualistic scarring and everything. And he wields the Necrosword, and the Necrosword, not a lot of embellishment on it, and is basically just a big old cross. Because, you know, like that's, I mean, if you're not going to embellish your sword at all, and you're going to make it just a very sort of classical, functional sword design, it's going to look like a cross. I thought it was, for me, anyway, a little sort of snuck in underlying message of Christianity overtaking, essentially, like, because we see a lot of what are pagan religions from Earth in the film. And so for Gore to be going through and basically wiping out all of these other gods and, you know, perhaps by extension religions, is, you know, I think sort of a little bit of a, like a wink and a nod to, you know, how, history's happened a little bit. That was, and I mean, and like they don't really lean into that theme a lot. It's more of, you know, essentially of what are mortals to gods. It's kind of the big thing, and like, what responsibilities do gods have to mortals? That's sort of the theme of the movie. And I mean, you know, you could argue that should be a lot more serious of a film. I think it works for this, you know, because it leads to some personal growth for Thor. You know, it's ultimately like, what is my job? You know, so I think that was great. I thought it was a little weird that Zeus is like in charge of all of the gods, like not just the Greek gods, but all of the gods. You know, I would have thought that, you know, like if they were going to go with, like maybe age, you know, do like something like some sort of old, vast, ancient god maybe is in charge. Or if it's like, if once you get past a certain point, like they just become too ancient and too esoteric to hold like essentially a bureaucratic position. And instead they're more like an elder god type thing. I don't know. I thought it was neat that we saw Celestials as part of that, sort of tying it back to Eternals a little bit. You know, and I kind of had my wife hasn't seen Eternals, so I kind of had to explain that a little bit. But, yeah, also weird how, and I saw this, like, nobody in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, like, post-Eternals, has kind of talked about the events of that film. Like, So, like, Tiamat was a celestial. Tiamat was the celestial that was supposed to hatch out of Earth, and, like, they basically killed her. And so now there's just, like, a giant head and a giant hand sticking out of, I think it's the Indian Ocean. And nobody talks about that. I think that might have been a good... This film would have been a good time to bring that up, I think, because it's kind of weird and absurd. But yeah. There's been some hubbub made about the visual effects. I don't know. Like, I don't know if I would have considered them to be, like, Marvel at their best. Like, I don't know if they're as good as they were in Ragnarok. But at the same time, like, I also didn't think they were that bad. I don't know. Maybe I just don't have a trained eye for seeing things and thinking, like, oh, well, you know, this doesn't look right. I don't know. Like, there are times when I think about, like, especially since, like, I listen to a film podcast from, like, the Frog Pants folks, you know, and, like, a lot of the stuff that they come up with of talking about, like, the cinematography and the different shots and what are filmmakers trying to convey with, like, different shots that they do and everything. And I'm like, man, I all that stuff escapes me when I'm watching a film. Like, I guess I just get so wrapped up, and, like, something has to really strike out and be bad or look off for me to think that something doesn't look quite right. And I think, like, there was a moment of that when I think it was in Shang-Chi, when I think it was, like, they tipped over a carriage or a cart or something, and, like, a bunch of gold spilled out. I think that was the one where I was like, oh, that did not look good. And I think the irony was, like, that might have been a practical effect or something. Something weird like that. Like, I don't know. Yeah, I didn't notice a lot of, like, VFX missteps in this film. You know, I'm certainly willing to be wrong on that. But maybe, you know, what I mean is, like, I'm willing to say, like, my eye might just not be that discerning toward it. I mean, you know, fight sequences, they all looked great. The soundtrack, I was expecting a lot more Guardians influence, because, like, the soundtrack seemed to be very heavily Guardians influenced. It seems like it was sort of a natural progression from Ragnarok. But then also, like, throwing in some Guardians of the Galaxy, they leaned very heavily on Guns N' Roses for this soundtrack. You know, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, I'm also of a generation where, you know, I still enjoy hearing Guns N' Roses. So, plus, I think it just went well with a lot of the fight sequences. I thought, especially the end sequence where they go to the Shadow Realm, whatever it's called, where just all the color drains out of stuff. And then, like, when you see things light up, they sort of bleed color back in around there where the light's showing. I thought that was great. That was such a nice, just very visually appealing effect. Yeah, fight choreography looked really good to me. The action sequences looked good. You know, Jane being able to wield Mjolnir, and not just like as the hammer, but then also the pieces of Mjolnir being able to separate out into the individual pieces and then sort of fly around and do that stuff. That just, like, that sort of introduces all sorts of neat thought experiments on, like, if Thor had been worthy still, or, like, had felt himself worthy, like, he could have, you know, figured out, you know, using his hammer in that way. But I also, you know, I like the fact that when you're inherently magical, like, say, a god, you know, words have power. And so when you say something that, like, might just be an offhand comment of, like, you know, Mjolnir will always protect you, you know, that suddenly, like, takes on a new meaning. And ultimately, that's why Jane's able to wield Mjolnir. You know, it's number one, she is worthy. And then number two, like, it's specifically entrusted to her to keep her safe. Yeah, I wish they would have kept her alive. Because it's sad. It's a sad ending. And especially, it would have been great to see more of her as the mighty Thor. Yeah. Actually, I think Thor does get Mjolnir back, actually, now that I think about it. Because I think that last sequence when he's now essentially raising Gore's daughter, she's wielding Stormbreaker. And I also, I don't know, I feel like a lot of people might have thought, like, the whole, like, weapons having intelligence and emotions and stuff is stupid. Listen, I play a game called Dungeons and Dragons, which has had intelligent weapons with their own personalities, their own agendas and everything for like 40, 50 years now. It's not that far-fetched. And if anything, like, I'm surprised that they haven't brought something like this up earlier with all of these, like, super enchanted weapons and everything that, like, just get thrown about willy-nilly. And the fact that, like, yeah, that Stormbreaker basically only came about because Mjolnir got destroyed and they needed it for a specific purpose. And now that Mjolnir's back, how, you know, as like a divine artifact, how do you handle that? Because, like, you have some sort of divine spark. There's going to be some sort of shenanigans there. But yeah. No, I mean, it, you know, I don't think it was too disjointed. You know, if you're a fan of the first two Thor films and you were kind of, like, you liked Ragnarok, but you didn't, you know, you kind of wished for a more serious Thor, like, you're not going to like this film. If you're like me and you like Taika Waititi's stuff, you'll probably enjoy this movie. I mean, if you're a big fan of Korg, you're really going to enjoy this movie. Yeah, one of the other things. There's a little bit of a weird inconsistency. So in Ragnarok, Thor mentions that the only people that showed up to his revolution were his mom and her boyfriend, whom he hates. And then in this film, he mentions that he's actually got two dads. And, like, that's how Cronin's, like, reproduces. Like, it's just, you basically do a handshake, and you go into a volcano, and then you come out with three Cronins. And like, that's how they reproduce. And, like, so that is, that's actually, I guess, canon to the comics. So it's, there's all sorts of theories, like, of ways of explaining what was likely a writing oversight. But of, like, does this mean, you know, like, does Thor have a transgender parent? Like, since Cronin's, I mean, like, since technically genderless, do they just sort of use whatever term if they feel like it? And, you know, since it's kind of a process that's totally alien to humans, we don't know. All that we know, it was likely a writing oversight, but there's all sorts of very fun fan theories circulating that are also causing a portion of the Marvel fan base to be like, oh, the movie went too woke. And I'm done with them. I mean, I've been done with that portion of the fan base. Like, I can't stand them. So, yeah. Yeah, we also got a little bit more push into Valkyrie and her what her deal is, and really sort of like it was hinted at in Ragnarok, but never explicitly stated that Valkyrie was lesbian. But they make it very clear in this film. And I think that's for the better. Like, get it out there. And don't kind of dance around the issue. I thought there was going to be a weird thing between her and Jane and Thor. They kind of seemed to imply that for a thing. And I thought that was, that was a neat little moment. But yeah, so I enjoyed it, I enjoyed it for what it is. I think it's worth watching. I think it's worth repeat watches. Saying as Thor Ragnarok is the film that gets watched the most in this house. it gets put on repeat a lot. I could see this being a repeat watch. I don't know if it ranks as high as some of the really great Marvel stuff, but that's okay. I think Marvel fans are kind of like Star Wars fans in this regard, where I feel like there is this expectation that everything has to be the greatest thing ever. And if it's not the greatest thing ever, that it is a complete and abject failure and disaster. And it's like, that's no. Everything can't be the greatest thing ever. Like, it's kind of mutually exclusive. It's okay for something to not be as good as, something else. And still be fun. And, I think it's still a good movie. So. Of course, I don't know. I was also clearly wrong about the Chip and Dale film. So what do I know? I guess, right? Since that's up for an Emmy. I think it's an Emmy. So, yeah. That is going to wrap up my review. So if you have seen it, what are your thoughts? If you haven't seen it, why did you listen? With that, let's move along to Questlog. Hey, so the goal last week was to do 5 pages of writer's notes for the 8-Bit Adventures comic book, Chapter 1. Nailed it. Absolutely crushed it. Crushed that goal. Turns out, when it's basically when the note is, you pick one thing that you just want to make a quick note of, and that's what you do for the page. It goes by a lot quicker, especially since it's the number of pages in the book is a significant fraction of the number of comics in the book. I think it seems like it's a much bigger daunting task at first, and then when you get into doing it, you're like, oh, this is perfect. Goal for this upcoming week is going to do 10 pages, and I'm likely going to crush that goal too. That's the hope anyway. And if that's the case, if I end up crushing it, I might just finish it. So, looking forward to that. But yeah, 10 pages. So if I can do that, boom, I have meet that goal. Looking forward to basically doing some panoramic art for the bottom of the pages. I think I'm going to enjoy that. And then we'll see. And then once I do that, there's not a whole lot left, actually. You know, maybe some full bleeds of artwork. So if there's any particular artwork that you know, of like any situations that you think might be neat for the main characters to be in, to be illustrated, you know, give me a shout out. However, just rest assured that just keep in mind, I'm gonna let you know right now is that, you know, the 8-Bit Adventures comic and all the characters and stuff and everything are copyright me, okay? Just want to get that out there. So, don't get any bright ideas. I don't know. So yeah, that's the goal for this week. That is going to wrap things up for our episode. Thank you all for listening to me talk about Thor, Love and Thunder. I hope if you got a chance to go see it, that you all enjoyed it as much as I did. If you're just coming back from this after skipping that whole section, I hope you do get a chance to go see it, because it's worth seeing, I think. So, as always, if you want to find more stuff from 8-Bit Adventures, you can check out the website over at 8-bitadventures.com. If you would like to help support all the stuff that goes into that site, including this podcast, other podcasts, the comics, the artwork, the live streams, all that stuff. The best way to do that is to become a patron over at patreon.com/8bitadventures. You can become a patron for as little as $1 a month. And you get early access to comics, patron-exclusive comics, behind-the-scenes D&D content, and more. Big shout-out and thank you to all of my current patrons. Thank you very much for your continued support. Basically, it goes toward hosting costs and providing stuff. Basically sort of building up materials for like Tales of Jamora stuff for when that show returns. So slowly but surely building up a collection of like maps and things like that. Because props are expensive, yo. So finally, our opening theme is one up by Professor Shy Guy. You can find his work over at professorshyguy.bandcamp.com. Thank you, Professor Shy Guy, for letting us use one up for 271 episodes and for like the past, I don't know, 5 years, 7 years, 6 years, however many years that I've been doing this podcast. Thanks a bunch. And hope you're doing well. Go support his stuff. That's going to wrap things up, folks. So without further ado, have fun, happy gaming, and enjoy your pie cake. Oh, I almost forgot it.